Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. The Let's Get Busy podcast is produced in part by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, award winners, up-and-comers, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 242 of the podcast with Tony Cliff, cartoonist of the Delilah Dirk graphic novel series, which recently saw the publication of its second installment, Delilah Dirk and the King's Shilling. Tony's art is superb, and what he accomplishes in the form of Delilah Dirk as a heroine is equally part Indiana Jones and Lara Croft and Kill Bill's The Bride. She's an amazing character to read. I can't stop recommending the book to my friends, and that includes you. You should totally pick up a copy of Delilah Dirk. It's rad. Here's episode number 242 of the podcast with Tony Cliff. Enjoy. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Tony Cliff.
Hello, Matthew.
Hey.
It is so nice to be here.
This is the sound of my voice. And you have now grown quite accustomed to my voice, having now spent our normal Mario Kart time instead spending time with one another talking.
Yes, this absolutely. Just endlessly.
I love it.
You said, maybe we should start this. And I said, wait, what about this other thing? And then I said, maybe we should start this. And you said, wait, about this other thing?
I do sort of always love that I get time with you, the guest, you know, before recording, because I feel like as much as I love that these recordings end up being just you and I talking and then we share them with the rest of the world, I love that still there's a moment, at least for you and I, a couple moments that still get to just be, no, these are just ours. It's nice to just know that happened.
Well, your listening audience might not be aware that we have been playing Mario Kart in a weird, like, sort of ad hoc kids lit group for several months.
That's
basically
right. Kid lit kart.
Yeah, kid lit kart. Yeah, exactly. Organized over Twitter. And, there
you go. It's really kind of fun. And it's really fun to be like, listen, Tony can draw comics better than I can, but I beat him the other day with 3 red shells and 1 blue shell. It was epic.
Yeah, exactly.
Take that, comic guy.
Always better with someone you know.
Yeah, it's nice. No, it's good.
Someone who you can trash talk afterwards.
Oh, it's lovely. Hey, congratulations on having a release during this 10 years of First Second, too. That's fun.
It is very exciting. I'm very happy for that book to be with First Second. Like, I know, like, it can sound like a, like, I'm sort of, are we allowed to swear on this podcast? I'm going to assume not. Like, to sound like, you know, like the company line or whatever, but I'm super happy with it. DD is with First Second. I feel like it's a really good home.
It is a great home. I think that they take really good care of their books and they know how to market them. And Delilah Dirk is no different. I loved reading Turkish Lieutenant. I thought it was rad. And then to have another one come out, it was even better when Gina was setting up these. Well, first, we set up this recording like months and months ago. But also to get the King's Shilling in.
I mean, your stuff is awesome. I mean, I
am so glad for you to find it, for this second book to finally be out, because the first one is a combination of like some of that artwork in there is 10 years old.
Really?
And it is so nice to, and it's like a combination of a story from here and a story from here. And it's all smashed together, and I'm finally nice. I'm so excited to have this, consistent.
Yeah.
One time, this nice solid chunk of more modern. Like I feel like I am very proud of this thing.
But your sophomore release, it's like you're a band. In the first CD, you spend ages and ages, your entire career on to put out the first album, mm-hmm. and then the second one is like all pure in where you are now.
Yeah. And if it's and if it goes like music, nobody will like it.
No. Well, at least it bought you a couple more days with the kids, because it is like an extra 100 pages, right?
Yeah,
exactly. You've got at least 3 more hours until a kid asks you when the third one's coming out.
Don't even get. No, you know what? Get me started on the on you know how long it takes to make a graphic novel versus how long it takes to read a graphic novel.
When you do your graphic novels, I should just open the cover to see. But do you have someone do the coloring for you, or do you have other people work with you on it, or do you do everything? Do you do everything? I only see your name.
Yeah, I do all of it, even all the, you know, oftentimes people will have color assistants who sort of set up the pages and do the coloring for them. And no, I just do it all myself.
Well, I like it.
Part of it is because I am a control freak.
Okay.
and to some degrees a perfectionist. But then part of it is also like in order to, you know, hire someone to do that, I would not feel comfortable unless I could pay them a really solid living wage for the time that they're doing it. And that is not something I am able to do right now. So until that becomes a reality, we'll just have to struggle through. And I got fast at it now. So it feels like it's faster for me to just muscle through it than to, you know, train someone. Like, I like my Photoshop layers like this. Thank you very much.
I can see that. I can see that you've got a flow going. You're already got a pace established that it's easier just to keep going yourself. I love the way you draw people, Tony. We were talking off recording about drawing human form and keeping that up, mm-hmm. keeping that practice up. The way you draw people is awesome. And the way you write story, I think maybe because I know you this way, and that's okay if it feels influenced in my brain that way. But I really like that your story feels paced like a video game too, right? I mean, I know that this is just sort of like the most epic, awesome sort of sword fighting, swashbuckling historical adventure with DD, but I really like that. And I really, really like the way you draw her and Salim and all the characters in motion a lot. Like, you really have captured that very well.
I am now completely fascinated with the ways in which you think it may be similar to video games, because, like, we were talking about listening to podcasts earlier before you started recording, and a lot of the podcasts I will listen to are video game podcasts, and I don't know, there's something about following the video game industry and what's going on in video games, and I've worked in video games a little bit.
Okay. What did you do in video games?
So,
I designed Uncharted, and then no.
long story short, I was part of a small sort of basically like a garage company that was trying to make a 3D physics-based action fantasy platformer for the PlayStation 2 in about, this would have been like 2002, 2003.
Wow.
It was very ambitious. And it never got made.
And you were like, guys, this game Star Fox is amazing. Let's do it with physics.
With a character with a magical tail that could manipulate 3D objects in the world.
Oh, my.
And I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with the hardware, technical specifications for the PlayStation 2, but it was not a powerful... it was not a powerful machine. Anyway, I don't know. But yeah, I am very interested in video games, and they fascinated me and everything. So now, but I had not, nobody's ever said that to me before. And I like that the book is similar or has features that, you know, you would draw, you compare to a video game.
Well, I mean,
I know there's a lava level and I know there's an ice level.
Yes.
So in those ways, of course. Why didn't I see it before?
Well, I think more when I pull that up, and this is something you and I had talked about too, about just playing video games since I was very young. I think there's a certain pacing that I link into when I read certain books that feel like that quality to me. Like I seldom read adult books, but reading, Ready Player One, like similarly had just a pacing that I was like, I don't know if it's paced, if that book in particular was paced for like my short attention span or something, but with this, there's a really good balance of, there are moments of exposition where we're having these deeper conversations with characters that we know are going to pay off later in the story. And then there's also plenty of pages where there is just focus on larger panels. Take in this detail, look at the scope of things. And then sometimes you just have full bleeds where it just feels like this is a moment you just need me to stop on as a reader and just take in what's going on. Take a breath before we go to the next action.
Oh. Well, okay, so yeah, it's funny that you should mention that, the sort of like the rhythm of how it all comes together, mm-hmm. and it is definitely, some of it is strategic and some of it is sort of intuitive. You know, like I've been reading comics my whole life, been playing video games my whole life, been reading books and watching movies my whole life, and so a lot of it is, you know, I'm pulling stuff from movies. I was trained as an animator, so. That explains some of that. And I, okay. You know, like when we were growing up, I would shoot movies with a video camera and everything. So trying to bring that sense of rhythm together and just sort of control the story of the flow or control the flow of the story. I was listening to Steve Lieber talk about, who is a Portland comics artist, talk on another podcast about how he, and I apologize, Steve, if you ever hear this, for mangling your words. He's talking about how he can sort of hear the music of a composition, or hear the way a composition sounds. I think that was the words. Those were the words he used. He could hear the way a composition sounds, like a page composition, or the way the story moves and that sort of thing. Which turned into like a little bit of a, it reminded me of a radio thing I had heard of, where somebody goes through listening to one of Mozart's symphonies, I believe, breaking down the sort of mathematics of repetition and, you know, callbacks and foreshadowing, and the layering of the different elements in the piece. And I think those are all, like, those ideas, if you want to, like, scale it way, way back and start thinking about, you know, the mathematics of it and that sort of thing, I think it's all, like, really transferable stuff. And I haven't spent a lot of time trying to articulate it, so it's still very difficult for me. But I think that's something you can find in all, I was going to say good, but yeah, okay, let's say good. I hesitate to say good because I don't want, you know, I must stay humble and not assume that this all applies to me. you know, like you look for those things in art, regardless of the medium, you know, whether it's video games, whether it's movies, whether it's music, or in this case, whether it's comic books. And so
there might even be a quality here, Tony, that makes me even just feel like maybe it's sort of a yearning. What I want is to see a Delilah Dirk video game or a movie or something. Like maybe it's that feel too, right? There's a certain, I don't know, transcendent quality in your story that feels like, oh, this could work across a different media. This doesn't just have to be comic. Or maybe that's why it appeals so strongly to my brain, because it works that well. And again, that sounds like it's coming from your background, which is great.
That is an interesting idea, because like you know, one of the questions now that, so I feel like comics were a good answer, a good solution to a problem, you know, in the middle of the 20th century where people were having really, really imaginative ideas, but film had not come along to a point where you could do the things that you see in a Superman or an Aquaman comic, right?
Right.
So comics were a great solution to that. So you come along, you can basically draw anything you can imagine. So the question now with comics, now that movies are basically, like a modern superhero movie is basically an animated movie. It's just that we've become so good at rendering, you know, 3D humans and 3D characters and special effects, creating a really, really believable, you know, degree of reality on the screen, that sort of thing. Now that we can do that, the question is like, what do we do in comic books? And there are some people who do really, really amazing things that you can only do in comic books. You mentioned Dave Roman's Astronaut Academy.
Yes.
Before, and I think that's a really good example of some, like, his comics feel like a thing that are very natural to comics. There's another guy named Brandon Graham who does a lot of work for Image. It's all sort of, I think he mostly does his own, you know, creator own stuff. But Brandon is amazing at doing something that could only ever exist as a comic. And so that's something, you know, that I try to work towards with making a comic. It's like, okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to spend a year and a half making this comic. And it's going to be a comic. So what are things I can do in it that are specific to comics that I could only ever do here that I couldn't do on a screen? Because I think if you look at like DD1, I didn't have a lot of comics experience. I mean, again, aside from reading comics forever, so I think it is very, like, it can have a tendency to read as kind of a storyboard for a film, which I think can be good because it can give you that feeling of reading, that you're reading a movie, and it can have that familiarity and that approachability and that expressiveness. But then, you know, like, since we're making a comic book, you know, what can we do more to take that and then build on that?
I need to call you out on something, because this is something that, as I reread Turkish Lieutenant like last weekend. I think I read it when it came out, which was, I don't know, like 2013 or 14. It was at least last year, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I reread it. Yeah. Yeah, 13. So I reread it, and I remembered immediately, because I was fooled again. You've got this great scene in this book, and I say this because this has not ever happened to me in another comic, and I love that it happens to me in this book. In so to contextualize this for listeners that haven't read this, you've got let me do my best. How do you pitch Delilah Dirk to new readers when you're at, I don't know, comic cons or something?
It is very, very hard, and I think it depends entirely on the person I'm talking to.
On the kid or the person. Yeah. I mean, this is sort of, she's a loner, and she's sort of like the most incredible badass you can imagine. I mean, in the beginning of Turkish Lieutenant, you've got this great, like, flipping to it now, we've got where Salim is reading back to that one high authority all the different things, that all the notes that he had taken about her, and that just to put her into context, saying she was raised this way and she battled here and she was trained here. I mean, that amps her up to such an incredible level, and then she delivers throughout both of your comics to be that exact person that her training has prepared her for. So I think to say she's sort of this ultimate swordsman, and she gets out of any predicament that she's in because she's very intelligent and very skilled.
There is that. I do want her to feel kind of a bit clumsy and sort of, what do you call it, skinnier teeth about it, though.
There you go. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, especially when she gets Salim, when she has this person going on with her, and you sort of get all of the steps along the way with the flying boat and the, I don't know that I should have trusted you with that, or no, I do need to trust you to take my boat, or just, that sort of, well, this might work for me alone to be surviving by the skin of my teeth, but when you throw another person in, now there's like two lives to worry about, which can end up being a little trickier. But the part I was going to say was when they, there's a scene where, not to give up too much, but where they're sneaking into a town and where Salim is told to watch the cart and to do this, and he daydreams. But the thing about that is that both times now that I've read it, because I had this deja vu, I did not get that he was daydreaming until there's a moment when
it transitions to surreal,
where it's surreal. There's the word where it becomes surreal, and you're like, oh, I get it.
I mean, it's supposed to be very. It's intentionally vague.
I just mean that is such good story writing, though, Tony. That's so good. And it's because it's in a comic that I like it, because then I can flip back and I can check back. Wait, what did I just read there? And go back. And I just, there's a lot of your stuff. I don't ever mean to say that, that it belongs anywhere than in the pages that it's in. It, your stories work very well as comics. And I think,
sorry, I guess I went on a bit of a tangent there and talking about, you know, comics versus movies and that sort of thing. And I was totally not, I didn't mean to, like...
Oh, no, I didn't mean to offend him to say, like, well, you know what this could be.
No, sorry, it's just a thing.
No, and I don't think I took it that way either. But I do just mean to say that you... There's sort of... Maybe the other thing I'm going through with this is that there's so much going well in this comic that I'm connecting to that it almost... It's that really great feeling that I talk about seldomly with picture books or with middle grade or with comics, where I feel like this comic feels like it was made for me. And that tells me exactly what reader I can hand it to and not even explain it and just give it to a kid and say, just read this. You're going to love this. I don't even need to tell you what it is. It would be better if you just take it and read it.
Well, thank you, because that I feel like I feel like the book needs a lot of that.
I don't know that I agree with you. I think your cover alone is enough to be like, oh crap, this is an action movie. This is, I would hate to ever put it in so simple of terms as like, it's a female Indiana Jones outwitting people left and right. But
I tell people, I mean, that is a line that I have often used at a convention. If you have a Indiana Jones shaped hole in your heart,
there you go.
You can slot this right in there. And I mean, like that is what I want it to feel like. I want it to feel like an Indiana Jones thing.
Yeah. I mean, it feels
certainly not going to hold that against you.
It feels like it feels like that great page turning feel of, when things settle down, especially when I went into the second book, that feeling of as things settle down, you know, this can only possibly last three page turns and then something is going to happen.
Well, I you're making my day. It's so glad to hear these things.
Well, I think I think through your animation background or storyboarding background or whatever, you have that pace going well where she's not, where Delilah isn't constantly running from trouble. There's chances to breathe. There's moments to slow down and take in what happened. And that allows me to appreciate the entire story as opposed to just feeling like it was just problem after problem after problem after problem. And then suddenly we're at the end of the book. It's great. Like I feel like these are characters that we know. And there's, I mean, in the second book, there's treason within the first, what, like 50 pages? I mean, it's the first quarter of the book. But there's characters that you know, and then there's questions that are thrown that feel like, wait, what's going on here? Who can I trust, and how are we going to get out of this one?
Oh, good. I'm glad the sort of like I don't want to call them lulls, but I'm glad the quieter stuff lands well. I don't know.
Oh yeah, no, I like that stuff the most. I appreciate that a whole lot.
I wonder if maybe it gives. I wonder if it makes it a little bit more. I am a huge James Bond fan.
Oh, there you go. See, I was gonna go the other direction. I was gonna go Han Solo with this.
So I'm a huge James Bond fan, but cool. James Bond in his adventure never stops and goes, wow, this is bonkers.
Yeah. Oh, my arm really hurts, guys. I really need to go back and take care of that guy.
Yeah. So I don't know. I want it to have, you know, kind of like a tangible quality, a tangible, relatable quality.
Yeah.
I don't know. I want it to be a lot of things, and I hope they all come through. But
yeah, I think it works well. Okay, so but tell me, though, you've been with this character for like 10 years, you said?
Yeah, absolutely.
How did this start? And then you've just sort of stayed committed to her, which is great because of where the story's gone. But where does she come from?
Would you like the very long version, the long version, or the short version?
I am sort of a super fan of these books, so I want as much as you're willing to give me without you falling asleep on yourself.
Oh, well, then that's fine. Okay.
Because I don't want to tell you, I don't want to try to make you tell me more than you need to, but I'm going to eat it all up, regardless of what you share.
Well, listener, buckle up. it was a thing I made, or I just started throwing together in the early 2000s, reading a bunch of Hornblower books and the Sharp series of books. Are you familiar with either of these?
No, I'm not. I'm going to write them down, though.
Sharp is the story of a rifleman in the British Army during the Peninsular War during the early 1800s. And the Hornblower series of books is set in the same time period, and it's about a naval man. Suffice to say, there's a bunch of adventure and intrigue, and it's like, you know, serial adventure stuff in a very sort of mid-century fashion. Hornblower was written during the middle of the 20th century, and Sharp is a more recent series, but okay. They're both set in the early 1800s, and they just sucked me in. And so I came up with this character and the sort of storyline and everything as kind of wanting to play in that playground.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And as also like as a solution to what I felt were were the problems I was having with comics, which is that, so I had just been reading a lot of Image comics during the 90s, and I hated the female characters in there.
Mm.
So I wanted to come up with a female character that was sort of fun to be around and, you know, smiled for once. Right. And, you know, had her own personality and thoughts and that sort of thing, instead of just being someone who shows you her butt and her boobs, you know, either alternately or at the same time. So it's coming from all these places in a lifetime, you know, of like loving Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
And like, you know, even DuckTales, I remember very fondly. There were episodes where they go and raid tombs in the, you know, in South America. Anyway, all this stuff, you know, throw it in a bucket, leave on high for about a year and a half. And I did, like 5 pages of this or something, just exploring this idea. And they're like the first 5 pages of what is chapter 1 in The Turkish Lieutenant. So
they stayed. They really stayed. I mean, I'm sure you edited them or, you know,
a little bit, but
tweaked them. But for the most part, like, they stayed. Yeah.
Yeah. Some of that stuff is from 2006.
Wow.
So I met Kazu Kibuishi. He had just, or I'd known him for a while. And then he started up the Flight thing and asked, would you like to contribute a story for Flight? I said, yes. As part of that, oh, man. Oh, yeah. So here we go. So that Flight story got nominated for an Eisner Award.
Oh, cool.
Which, you know, blew my mind after, you know, a lifetime of reading Wizard magazine and hearing about how the Eisners are, you know, quote unquote, the Oscars of the comics industry.
There you go. That's right.
So there was no chance that my odds of winning this Oscar, winning this Eisner were very slim, but, you know, almost non-existent, right?
And it got you on the radar, yeah.
Well, not even so. If you know, like there was that 1% chance that this thing was going to win in the category it was nominated, I was not going to be in absentee from the ceremony. So I got my first exposure to San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah.
Which was really, like, my first exposure to a modern comic convention.
Okay.
And all, like, at the flight booth, you know, all of the other flight artists were there. And everybody had, you know, their amazing artwork out on the table. People did minis and everything.
Yeah.
And I was exposed to this, you know, idea of making a little, making your own little comic and just, you know, taking it to Comic-Con and that sort of thing. So, go back home. I dig up these DD pages and I sort of post them on the flight forums and say, hey guys, here's a thing I was working on. You know, God, I don't know what's going to go on next. I'm just posting these here because I drool. And I remember very vividly Doug Holgate, who you might know from, who is an Australian comics artist.
Yeah.
And is a lovely gentleman in his own right. He was like, you have got to finish this. So I did. And I made this 30-page short story. And that short story is chapter one in The Turkish Lieutenant.
Yeah.
You know, everything from the point where it says chapter one up to the point where they get on the boat together. That was in this black and white 30-page comic, which I took down to San Diego the next year. Okay, now I'm going to start shortening this story. It got nominated for an Eisner Award.
Shut up. Oh, my word.
So, like, you know, what do you do when you are interpreting these reactions to your work in such a strong fashion? You know, like, what do you
quit everything and start making comics.
I mean, it's just
Mom,
like,
I'm gonna make comics. Leave me alone.
Well, so, and then, I don't know, a little bit later on, Kazoo started making Amulet.
Yeah.
Reyna was, I think, this was just about when she was starting to do Smile. I might be wrong on that.
She had been doing the Babysitter's Club stuff, yeah.
Yeah, Jake Parker, I think, was...
he had been in Flight by that point and was probably working on Missile Mouse, or
yeah,
close to it.
He was in Flight before I...
Yeah.
But yes, Missile Mouse happened. And so I'm like, oh, maybe I should take these two stories. So at that point, I had done that first DD short story and then a Delilah Dirk short story for another Flight anthology, and sort of smush them together and add some stuff in the middle. Cause I had I had designed them from the start that they could work chronologically.
Okay.
And you could mush them together. So I took a year off of work and sort of basically made the prologue and, you know, like 100 additional pages in the middle and at the end. Tried to get that made into a book. And then, you know, a lot of stuff happened and it took a while, but eventually now here we are with Turkish Lieutenant out from for a second. But going back to the early part of the process, like one of the things I can't emphasize enough to anybody who is getting into comics is to, you know, like absolutely start small. Like,
yeah, I'm for you so... to start a 5-page comic and allow it to grow from there into a 30-page, and from there into that, instead of trying to say, okay, I've never made a comic before, let's do 150 pages.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so, you know, you can't really emphasize enough how indebted I am to Kazoo for starting the Flight anthologies and basically introducing me to this world. But yeah, like anybody now, I would say, like, just do something small, do a short story, a 30-page story. You'll get it done. Then you'll know how you like to work. You know, it works for you. What doesn't work? You'll have that feeling of having done something, like finished a project, instead of always having something looming, over your shoulder, saying, you know, when are you gonna get back to finishing me, that dream project of yours?
Yeah.
Just tackle something small. You can definitely finish. And then the bonus to that is that you can take aspiring off of your Twitter bio. You know, you don't have to be an aspiring comics artist anymore. You can be, you are just a comics artist. You have finished a comic. It exists. You are a comics artist, you know, like that feels good. but anyway, so that is sort of, that is sort of the story of DD and how it started as short stories and got all smushed together. And
well, so how did you get it over onto First Second though? How did you approach them, or was it through the work in flight or something like that? How did you?
So, Gina. So this is also because of San Diego.
I was going to say they must be showing there at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, and because of Flight Comics, like I had met Raina, and Raina invited me out for breakfast one time at San Diego, and there was a lady there named Gina. And so I don't know. So she works maybe for a second or something. And I met Gina, and like, you know, we had breakfast and waffles and everything. At that point I had made a sort of dummy of the entire Turkish Lieutenant thing. I was just passing it around the table, you know, okay, action sort of thing. And you know, nothing came of that, you know, that breakfast or whatever, but that was my first meeting with Gina, and I could never imagine, you know, at that point that, you know, like it's so insane. Like we just, you know, we had breakfast that one day, and I could never imagine that, like now we, you know, email daily because, you know, she's, you know, the public facing side of her second, basically.
Yeah. Because she's Gina. I was going to say, she's the one I talk to. If I talk to anyone from First Second, it's her, which means if she's talking to me and to you as much as she is doing, she must be talking to a million billion people all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. No, she's absolutely one of the hardest working people in comics. I am convinced of it.
No doubt. And she's super nice and knows how to draw like really good people in. I mean, we were talking again before recording about how there's like four people that work over at First Second that really run the whole place. And to know that it's those people that are helping to bring the comics that we have already from them. I mean, in 10 years to have some of the best stuff in front of our readers right now is just, it's awesome to know that you've got such strong advocates over there.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like such a good, you know, place for, I mean, it's a place that I'm very proud to be at, you know, being published by First Second, because, well, for a lot of reasons, but, yeah, I remember like a San Diego experience was discovering the First Second booth, and I think the sort of the buzz around the flight table was like, who is this, like, First Second? They seem to have a lot of cool books.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the fight people are animators.
Yeah.
And as animators, we're drawn towards French comics, which, you know, like, there are a lot of animation people, like... The art in French comics is of a style that is way more diverse than mainstream North American comics. And I don't know if your listeners are aware of that. But, you know, we have superheroes over here in North America. And in France, like, superhero comics are not much of a thing.
No.
And, like, that sort of style that we associate with animation is much more of a mainstream style in France and Belgium that is not necessarily associated with Disney cartoons. Or, you know, you can do something that's sort of animated looking, but people won't necessarily say, oh, this is, you know, a kid's product, the way people make that association over here.
That makes sense. Was at a conference and the Unshelved guys were there, the guys who do that comic for Unshelved. And the entire session, I went to a couple of the sessions, and the entire session was great comics that are just out there now. And I'm willing to bet at least half of the ones they mentioned were all French for that exact reason, that just they're making things there that just look different from what we have here.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say one's, you know, better or worse or whatever, just that there's just a different sensibility about making comics there.
Yeah, totally. And I don't, like, just personally, I always feel really guilty about saying this because I know a lot of people working in mainstream comics. And I know a lot of people who enjoy reading floppies or whatever thing, but I do not enjoy that style of consuming comics, like with floppy comics.
Mm.
I do not enjoy having ads in my books. I do not enjoy storylines that go on forever. I hate it when I get into a story and then the artist changes.
Mm.
All of these things, you know, to me feel like problems that need solving within comics. So, you know, wherever possible, I've tried to do that, you know, myself, you know, with DD. I don't assume that that's the same for everybody, but Anyway, whatever. makes First Second a good match. Those were the reasons I was alluding to when I was talking about how great First Second is.
I hear it.
That style of, you know, reading a, you know, picking up a book and reading it front to back.
Yeah.
And there you get a complete story, a beginning, a middle, and end.
Right. Oh, I should say too, because we were talking about this off recording, and I have it in my hands, and I like that to know that you were behind it. That First Second is passing out now these flyers, these foldables, the graphic novels are. To know that you had a hand in designing it, and that it's here. It's a consumable that we can share with parents, and that mm-hmm. you know, you can find at conferences that help facilitate that conversation to colleagues and also to parents on just, so what is this thing that is a graphic novel?
Yeah, it's hard, like, once you've got your head in the industry, and you would probably have a much better idea of this than I would. Like, what does, you know, your average civilian think of comics and, mm-hmm. you know, graphic novels and that sort of thing? I imagine there are a lot of people who assume, you know, like, if you say graphic novel or if a comic is very thick, they assume, oh, you know, it must be boring and black and white, because, I don't know, for me, that, you know, a long time, for a lot of my growing up, that is the sort of association I had. But
well, and a lot of the thing I continue to hear from parents, which is fine, because it just shows that they just don't know yet. Or it's hard, I think, as a parent, and knowing that this is what I am approaching, I try to do my best with, if I question what my kid is reading, and he's not reading independently yet, but it'll happen. instead of questioning what they're reading, to read it myself. And I think a lot of parents look at comics and think, or the phrase that I hear a lot is, he can read these books, but he needs to read something harder too. He needs to read something with more substance. And when you're saying those things, I think what they mean is, to them, substance equals a word count, which is the way that they were probably raised. So I'm not trying to fault parents for that. But at the same time, I think that the complexity of stories, I don't need to tell you this, of course, but the complexity of stories that occur in graphic novels, I mean, this is a format that, much like a picture book format or a narrative format or even a free verse format, that format is selected in order to tell the story in the best way possible, to serve the story the best way possible. And it just, if the word count is lower in a graphic novel, then that stands to reason that the illustration is also doing a lot of the heavy lifting.
Which is, like, two things. I mean, I definitely understand the association. Like, even just looking at a comic book, you're like, well, okay, but this is very simple and easy to parse. Like, you know, maybe a parent looks at a graphic novel and it's like, oh yeah, it's got pictures. So, you know, we would like our son to be reading things that carry more literary weight. But then it is so easy to just completely dismiss our ability to parse that visual presentation.
Yeah.
To process and interpret, you know, the emotions that you read in a two-dimensional picture on a page.
Yes.
And to, you know, to to go back to Scott Adams, right? Scott McCloud.
Yeah.
To go back to Scott McCloud, you know, do that work of building the scene in between the panels.
Exactly.
You know, where the magic happens in the gutters.
And you've got two. One of the other cool things that I always think happens in graphic novels and in that transliteracy piece where we're reading not only the words and the art, but also what happens, you know, between the panels. You've also got, because you've got such a strong design for character, and because you're designing a female character here, I feel like you're making a character that you've got a lot of. Okay, so there's a lot of positioning of Delilah in both of your books that are positions that I would take on to reenact the character. Does that make sense? Like poses?
I was wondering if you meant poses or like
poses.
Positioning as in terms of, you know.
No, not like on a scene. Oh, no. Oh, you went even somewhere different. I was actually thinking like cinematically, which you also do really well. You tend to draw, I feel like you, it's very clear to see what you're comfortable drawing, because you draw architecture and exploding architecture and animals and people, all pretty balanced. Whereas I've noticed, which is fine, but I've noticed in some artists that there tends to be much more focus on faces or much more focus on background, and that, all of that is fine. You seem to have a really good balance of everything. But no, Tony, what I'm referring to is that there are poses that Delilah makes, the frames that you have her frozen in, that are really awesome and remind me of like when I played Mega Man and I would make those poses and I was like, I am Mega Man because I'm making the exact pose that he makes. There's like these, I always go back to, I don't know why I'm obsessed with this. I talked to Ben Hackey about this too. I need to not be obsessed with this, but I'm obsessed with the idea because you have a comic. Kids can literally see themselves as Delilah Dirk. You become Delilah Dirk because you see yourself in the main character. And then there's opportunity for cosplaying. And this character is like rad to dress up as because of like the wrapping that you've got of her garment and the different colors and the satchels everywhere. And I just feel like, you've signed a rad character. Possible. Yeah, especially even the hair alone. But it is awesome.
Yeah.
You've almost got like a tamed Bayonetta hair. No, but there's a lot of...
Does your audience know who Bayonetta is?
Who knows? There's a lot of... we were talking before. All of the artists listening are gonna know exactly the every single video game reference that I make. But there's some poses here too that look, you've got like some nice anime frozen poses where like her skirt is like frozen out in a fan shape or in this circular shape. There were just ways that you drew her that I felt like were visually strong.
Matthew, I do not know what to do with these compliments. I can only.
Well, I don't even know how to say the things I'm doing. Thank you for bearing with me as I try to articulate. Oh, you make pretty pictures. I like them. No, I like the way you draw though. It's cool. It's rad.
A lot of that comes from, it just comes from animation and you know,
just drawing a lot, and that's your aesthetic. I like it. It's good.
Yeah, but also, you know, like you talking about the heroic poses and that sort of thing.
Do you think that there's stuff that you just sort of, that it is, maybe for all of us, it's ingrained when you're positioned this way, you know, shoulders down or sharp elbow up holding a sword or whatever. That's what you do. That's how a hero holds a sword.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It must be, right?
Well, I mean, you can break it down to even... greater minutiae than that, and just like talk about ways like how body language reads.
Yeah.
And you know, whether it's aggressive or fearful. I mean, my favorite bits are the bits where I can put her in a position that is funny. Like if I could get her in a pose that is like absurd or weird or
you mean like
maybe it's not even like specifically the pose. It's just like a shot that looks silly. Like I really am. I am very proud of the. There's a panel at the front, near the front of Turkish Lieutenant, where she's just like sitting lazily against the wall of the cell.
Yes,
and she's just completely deflated and manacled. And she says, "No, thank you. I only drink the blood of my enemies," basically. those are the ones.
What comes to mind for me is in King Shilling, when the redcoats have come and they're in the water, and Delilah's in the water and Salim's in the water, and they say something like, "Do you want the long version or the short version?" And she's like, and "He says short," yeah. And she just said, "How to avoid the French? We go around." And he says, "Fine, long." And you have her face like scrunched up and her fingers just pointing down to the water going, "We go around."
That is that is a direct homage to Jeff Smith, where in one of the very, very early volumes or issues of Bone, who's the one who wears the black shirt? Is that Phone Bone? No, Phone Bone's the main one.
I don't remember the names. My kids are gonna hate me for not knowing the names.
It's been a while since I have read, I haven't my read him in a while. Edition.
Yeah.
No, but he says to somebody, you know, have you seen him around, and draws that shape with his fingers. And that's and I felt like such a fanboy the first time. The first time when I met, I had a chance to actually meet Jeff Smith. I was like, I love this one sequence. Have you seen him all around? You can't. This would be much better if you could see my hands also doing the gesture. Oh, man.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's cool that you can also do nods like that in your comics to nod it to the people that are doing it. I like it.
Oh, man. That one stuck with me. So that's so deeply. It's just like.
So are you like midway into working on book three by now?
I am in the very early stages of working on book three. I have a finished manuscript.
Okay.
So I write every, or I'm saying this like, this is the way I do it. This is the
I write every day.
This is the practice that is tried and tested. So for book two was the first time I had ever tried to do, you know, a very long graphic novel all at once. So I thought, well, the best way to, one of the problems with graphic novels is that since they take so long to make, it's hard, you know, if you wait that entire time for feedback, how will it ever be useful to you,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like you can, if you come up with a joke or write a song, you can tell it on stage or you can perform it on stage and
tweak
immediately,
it immediately. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But with graphic novels, you can't do that. So, I wanted multiple steps along the process of making this big, long 200 plus page book, where I could show it to people and say, what do you think of this? Is this working? Is this not working? So I said the best way to do that would just be to write it all out like a novel, which is what I did. So I just write out the whole thing like it was a prose novel. And, you know, I cheat here and there. And so I'm just at the point where I finished that part of the process for book three. And then I print it all out and I just sort of revise and make notes in the margins and that sort of thing. But it's got to the point where I think the story is pretty good. I'm pretty happy with where it is right now.
Well, good. Well, congratulations on that moving along. Do you have any other stuff that you're working on in the meantime, or are you all focused on Delilah Dirk? I don't know. I don't know you beyond. I don't know. Like, are you still working in animation? Are you still doing freelancing for other stuff?
I was doing some animation work last year after. I took some time last year to do some book pitches and that sort of thing, and I did some animation work as well. But no, mostly. Right now I am illustrating a book, which, and I don't know how much of it I can say, but I'm very excited about it.
Cool.
It is a sort of. Is it middle grade? It's something. I would just say that it's sort of inspired by the Graham piece. His like 11th hour books. Are you familiar with these?
Oh, Graham Bass 11th hour. Yeah, with the hidden,
with
stories
all the hidden
in
details,
them.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I'm not writing this, and it's sort of an illustrated novel.
Cool.
But it's got all those sort of like hidden codes and stuff.
Oh, that would be way fun.
Maybe I've already said too much about it. But
is it much?
But no, yeah, and then I'm just looking forward to DD3 because it is a book. Unified, globe-trotting, tomb-raiding, action adventure type thing. In a way that I think maybe DD2 was like a little bit more, a little bit quieter, and maybe a little bit more introspective, maybe.
Yeah.
And a little bit more about the character interactions, that sort of thing. Book three will, you know. It's not going to be wildly different, but it is going to be, you will recognize a lot of the features in it from, you know, everything we associate with sort of adventure genre and that sort of thing.
That'd be great.
It's loud, and it's fun, and it's crazy, and that sort of thing. So
I'll be excited to check it out. Thanks, man. Tony, thank you so much.
I am excited to show it to you.
Thanks for coming on the podcast for this chat and for just really letting me be a fan of yours. I'm excited that more Delilah Dirk is on the way, that you are staying with her for a while at least, and that we get to keep enjoying her, because it's really great. I really do think that it's one of the best comics going, and I'm really glad that I get to connect with it as well as I do, and then share it and have those connections that I get to share with readers, because it's cool to be able to connect that way with them over something that you enjoy as much as you do too. So that's cool. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the support so much. And thank you for all of the kind words. It means a lot to me.
Let's Get Busy is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland, and by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton and The Best Book Ever This Week. Our theme music is by Blue Ducks. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that is a very good thing indeed. Next up on Let's Get Busy, Philip Stead shares the story behind Ideas Are All Around, his new picture book. And after that, Karen Rivers talks about The Girl in the Well Is Me, her newest middle grade novel. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.